liberal, progressive, and radical radio in Los Angeles. And so today we hope this forum enriches our understanding of this struggle and also gives us ammunition, if you'll pardon my expression, to reach out to our communities and explain what is this struggle all about and what are the implications. If we lose a radio station and a network that has traditionally explained to new activists and young people who are coming up the ideological foundation for our movement toward social and economic justice. I might just close this brief introduction by saying I was really moved by reading on the net the words of one of our programmers at KPFK, Verna Avery Brown, when she left the station and actually explained how even working in the station had changed very much her own political outlook, and that she was transformed by working there and then saw that the things that transformed her were being lost and finally left. You'll hear from her just a little bit later. Welcome on behalf of the ad hoc committee for the forum. We'll get right into this. One piece of bad news I have for you. I should have maybe plexiglass in front of me so I can fend off the fruit and so on. Larry Bensky has just sent word just this morning that he cannot be with us. He was ready to get on the plane, and he's suffering from a severe bronchial problem. Larry Bensky, as you well know, was a national affairs correspondent for Pacifica Radio from 1987 to 1998. He was fired twice by Pacifica as it tried to change the nature of the network, first in December of 98 and then in April of 99. At that time of his firing, Bensky hosted the popular nationwide talk show, first the Daily Living Room and then the weekly Sunday Salon. He's been one of the leaders in the movement to recapture Pacifica, recapture his own station. He has sent a statement which I'm going to read before I introduce our first speaker. And I think it's a very telling one, and I'm going to try to give it what it deserves, a clear reading. These are the words of Larry Bensky, a general overview and summary of how things are at KPFA in Berkeley. I've been asked to give a general overview to begin today's session and a summary of how things are at KPFA. I should say that I most definitely do not speak for everyone at KPFA, and my insights and conclusions are my own. But they are based on more than 30 years of experience inside Pacifica, and most of you know my history there. My general sense of Pacifica right now is that it is at an all-time low. What so many of us had worked so many years to build has been almost totally destroyed during the past few years. We now have no internal common direction, a mysterious but probably horrible financial situation, and a betrayal of our principles and traditions. The good people remaining within our station feel threatened and afraid. In many cases, they're too afraid to speak out. Many other workers, including a third of KPFA's paid staff, have quit in varying degrees of disgust and disillusionment. Our hard-fought reputation has been besmirched by the arrogant and unresponsive board and management clique, which has tried disastrously to impose itself on us from above. Just as bad, the goal and direction of their authoritarian actions, other than getting more listeners and diversity, have never been defined. And what has always been difficult in this process of programming, fundraising, and community building within our station has now been made even more difficult. Needless to say, our reputation as an organization has also sunk to an all-time low. That's the bad part. But there's a very good part as well. An enormous national and even international movement has grown up to support those of us who are struggling to restore free speech and community control of Pacifica. We have managed to force the announced departure, though they're not gone yet, of the architect and implementer of this catastrophe, Mary Frances Berry and Lynn Chadwick. Pacifica's board and management have drawn no support for their actions outside of a handful of opportunists inside our stations and in the so-called public radio community. The overwhelming majority of those who look at our situation understand what's being destroyed here and are willing to help us fight to save it. Our challenge, as I have been saying in public and private since the day Nicole Zawaya was fired a year ago, is to treat this as the political situation that it is, to educate people about what's going on, to organize the energies of our supporters so we can get our organization back to the critically important work for which it was founded over 50 years ago, informing and enlightening our listeners about the politics and culture, which are more than ever censored from commercial and so-called public media channels. We must insist that our local and national boards be selected democratically so that the kind of usurpation of power and authority that have taken place recently can never happen again. We must insist that free and full discussions of what's going on inside our stations and inside Pacifica be regularly broadcast on our air. We must insist that Pacifica's finances be completely transparent, with an end to secret hirings, expenditures, and bookkeeping. Our struggle here at KPFA has been a hard one, both inside the station and in the community. But it has paid off. We have seen a record amount of money pledged to our station over the past year, and a rise in listenership as well. We have rallied political support from many organizations and elected officials. We've taken legal action. There are now 4 lawsuits pending against Pacifica, each of which is designed to reverse the damaging actions of the board and management. And we will continue on all these fronts. For me personally, Larry says, it has been a very difficult period. Many times I've thought of walking away from this often exhausting and frustrating struggle. And many people ask me, why don't I? The answer is simple. It would be a betrayal of all that I've worked for over the years to give up. And the people whom I most admire in the world politically and journalistically never gave up. Ida B. Wells, Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King Jr., I.F. Stone, and countless others whom I've studied and some I've known had many reverses and dark moments, but they pressed on. We have an opportunity. We have an unprecedented opportunity to recover and transform Pacifica. Today's meeting is part of that work. I salute you for your presence here today, and I urge you to continue to join in our struggle. All the best to you, Larry Bensky from Berkeley. Well, that's a good keynote, and I was very honored to deliver it for Larry Bensky. Now, I think we'll get right into our program. I mentioned a woman whose words as she left Pacifica were very meaningful to me. Verna Avery Brown, from 1988 to 1990, was the Capitol Hill correspondent of Pacifica Network News in Washington. From 1990 to 1991, she was producer of Unistar Radio Network in Crystal City, Virginia, where she produced five-minute newscasts for 24-hour radio, and where she produced live audio feeds to 50 affiliates from Capitol Hill, from NASA, and from Camp David. From 1992 to 1999, Verna Avery Brown was Pacifica National News anchor in Washington, D.C., where she anchored a daily national newscast, did spot coverage of Congress, interviewed national and international newsmakers, and was editor and did general news work. She has a degree from American University in Washington, D.C., with an emphasis on broadcast journalism and a double major in psychology, which I'm sure she's been able to use at times dealing with some of the folks she's been working with. She's toured South Korea, Thailand, Japan, and the Philippines on fact-finding tours with other international journalists. She's now executive producer of a nationally syndicated show, Radio Avant-Garde, which will begin airing in the fall of this year. Let's have a warm Southern California greeting and welcome to Verna Avery Brown.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Scott, please. Thank you very much. That's very generous, but I have to be able to recognize myself when I leave here. More importantly, my four sons and my husband have to be able to recognize me when they pick me up at the airport, and not a whole lot of applause coming from that group. They do, however, bring me flowers on occasion, usually some they've plucked from the neighbor's yard, unfortunately, but they're learning. They mean well. I didn't really come here to talk about my role as a mother and as a wife, although that's a very important role in my life. I came to talk about my role as the former anchor of Pacifica Network News. Thank you. I think. I'm going to talk about the reason I decided to resign my position. We just heard Larry Binsky. Well, we just heard Don articulate Larry Binsky's reasons for staying, and I feel as though I have to articulate my reasons for leaving, because we all choose how we want to fight these struggles and these battles. So in doing so, I'm going to go back a little bit to the beginning of my tenure at Pacifica Network News. When I first walked through the doors of the Pacifica Network News room in 1988, I was coming straight out of a career in commercial radio news. Back then, if I did happen to switch to an FM radio station, it was by accident, while I was really surfing the dial looking for the Motown sound or something. I was what you might call the epitome of political incorrectness. Politically, I was clueless. If it wasn't the Republicans, the Democrats, or the mean old communists, they had not registered on my political radar screen. The Green Party, the Socialists, the Libertarians, you could have put what I knew about those parties in your eye and still not blink. I'm just being honest here, folks. The Chiapas Indians, East Timor, none of these things meant a thing to me. I may as well have landed on another planet when I stepped through that newsroom in 1988. And as a general assignment reporter, I was expected to not only learn about these issues, but to care about them and to portray them in such a way that others might hear and be informed and also learn to care about these issues and to become active. Over the years, I was assigned to different stories every day, a different subject. And somewhere along the line, I really began to hear these stories. I heard the story of Julia Butterfly, the woman who made her home in a giant redwood tree for years in order to protect it from the loggers who were perfectly content with raping the old growth forest in order to increase their precious profits. I heard the story of the 9, 10, and 11-year-old girls that lived in Bombay, India, who were forced or stolen away from their families and forced into sexual slavery, or in some cases given away by their fathers to help earn money for the families, forced to put on makeup and perform sexual favors at these tender young ages at the moment they reached puberty so their families wouldn't have to starve to death. And I began to realize that their stories of economic deprivation was not really so different from the stories of the young African-American women and girls right here across the U.S., who because of their lack of resources and their lack of nurturing and lack of recreational opportunities and facilities are left to fend for themselves and to raise themselves. And they wound up fighting and killing one another in after-school skirmishes and fighting for entertainment. The girls that I spoke to are now serving lengthy sentences for murder before they've even had a chance to live. And so over the years, hearing those stories, I began to see the geopolitical, socioeconomic connections between the lives of the people of color across this continent, indeed around this world. The controlling forces of the IMF and the World Bank. The impotency of the UN, the U.S. military-industrial complex. And for the first time, I saw the puppets and the puppeteers. And if I can just sort of digress for a moment here, when the protesters came to Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago by the hundreds and demonstrated in front of the World Bank and the IMF and formed human chains, endured the tear gassing and the police beatings to confront the powers that be and to try to prevent business as usual, I felt a little bit of pride. Pride in knowing that Pacifica has been covering that story for years. And I wondered how many of those protesters out there had gotten their information from the stories that we had been doing at Pacifica for many years. The PNN has long been exposing the inhumane, exploitive policies of the IMF and the World Bank, and I could tell by the superficial coverage that the TV stations, the mainstream TV stations and radio stations were providing, that not very many of those reporters were very well versed on the issues surrounding that controversy. Point of fact, I understand that the last of the protesters, the demonstrators, have been released from jail after an extraordinary display of solidarity and tenacity and displaying grace under pressure. And I just wanted to just give them a congratulations for a job well done. And those demonstrators were mostly young people. And so there is indeed hope for us in this struggle. But back to my early years at Pacifica, when I began to hear the stories, I heard the plights of the African-American farmers eloquently articulated and dramatized when they brought a caravan of tractors led by a mule they named Struggle to the front of the White House. The institutional racism and injustices practiced against those farmers had them was so deeply rooted that it took court orders to get them what was rightfully theirs. I remember when the farmers' caravan came to D.C. and marched down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, and I was assigned to cover that story. I just could not resist the urge to climb up on that tractor with the leader and interview him as the caravan proceeded. You know, and I saw some of the other reporters say, "Who is that?" You know. And then they found out, they said, oh, Pacifica, and kind of smirked, you know. But, you know, I really felt proud to have that distinction, to wear that distinction, to be a Pacifica reporter. I felt proud because I know the rich legacy of Pacifica. I know Pacifica has been a constant refuge for great independent thinkers of this world. People like Paul Robeson, Allen Ginsberg, Malcolm X, Whoopi Goldberg before her pre-Hollywood days. I know the legacy of Pacifica, and, you know, and just looking out here today and seeing all you, and this just sort of completes the picture for me. And it really does touch me in my heart in a very special way. There's so many other stories, and I could really go on for hours. I mean, there's a story of Granny D., who I'm sure all of you know, who walked across the country to protest campaign finance reform. It's that spirit. While Pacifica covered her story even before she got to the end of her trip. And there was the young, white, or rather Jewish guy who turned his skin black for a college experiment. He took some pills, and he couldn't stand being black for more than a week. A week, because of the way people were responding to him, nothing had changed about him except for the color of his skin. The lesson, racism is alive and well in America. He told me when he had decided to end his experiment and wanted to return his skin to the natural color He scrubbed himself so hard his skin began to bleed. I mean, there are countless stories. I'm not going to stand here and try to go over every one. I mean, it was an 11-year career. But the one thing that made a major impression on me when I first walked through the doors over 11 years ago were the people that I met in the newsroom. I was the only African-American, of course, back then. I think we were called black at that time. But they, my white, oh, so liberal colleagues, were all just as sensitive to the issues of racism and ageism and sexism and all the other isms as I was, and in many cases were better informed. Yet we all understood that my perspective was unique and was entitled to be a part of the mix and the dialogue. When I first got there, I wasn't exactly what you'd call homophobic. But let's just say I had a whole lot of questions about homosexuality, and they all began with why. Why would anybody want to? Why are some people attracted to the same sex? Why this? Why that? But through my work at Pacifica, I came to understand why. But more importantly, I realized that the question is really not why, but why not? Why shouldn't people be allowed to express their sexual orientation, however it manifests within them? Why shouldn't they have equal protection to pursue their own choice of lifestyles? Why shouldn't their beliefs carry just as much weight as anybody else's? Why not? And while I am still just as straight as the day I was when I walked through the door, I'm proud of it, I like to think I'm not narrow in my thinking. And I thank God and Pacifica for that deeper understanding of my fellow human beings. Yes, I said God. Ooh. Most of my white colleagues are atheists, agnostics. And of course, that didn't sit well with me back then, with my Baptist middle class upbringing. But while I heard them saying they didn't believe in God, their actions, their compassionate nature, their commitment sure seemed divine to me. Case in point, Amy Goodman from WBAI, who was literally caught in the crossfire of the brutal military regime trying to protect the lives of East Timorese activists by giving voice and international attention to their cause. And I reached the point where I really didn't care whether my colleagues believed in God or not, as long as they just kept doing what they were doing. And it was all right with me. I was going to believe in God enough for all of them. And when I met other African Americans and people of color within the network, people with that same fiery spirit and passion and commitment, people like Samori Marksman of WBAI and Dred Scott Keyes, Jose Santiago, Cheryl Flowers of KPFA, and we just recently saw Errol Maitland of Democracy Now, who is recovering as we speak. Yeah. From wounds ruthlessly inflicted on him by New York City police officers as he simply attempted to cover the funeral march of Patrick Dorismond. And once again, I had an opportunity to really feel proud to be amongst this caliber of people called Pacifica. And so when the confrontation at KPFA took place, it brought things to a head at PNN, the newsroom. For some time, there seemed to be a rift developing. Two distinct political camps were forming. There were those who seemed to carry with them a respect for the principles upon which Pacifica was founded, and there were those, and they remained committed to the struggle for equality and social justice and peace, and seemed eager to do whatever it took, whatever was necessary to protect those rights. And then there were those who seemed to no longer fully embrace these ideals with the same amount of fervor that they had years ago. and moreover, went out of their way to question the need to cover stories and certain angles, things like affirmative action. They rolled their eyes when stories involving gay and lesbian rights were pitched during the morning news meetings. Issues concerning African Americans or other people of color were routinely placed at the bottom of the newscast. And the days when on the days when these individuals were producing the show, and many of my story suggestions were just summarily dismissed as, "Where's the news peg? Where's the news peg?" To which I would sometimes argue, "Well, it's news because I say it's news." Because not enough people realize this is a crisis and that this crisis is underway. Our standard of news cannot simply be whether ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN and the rest of the corporate-run media deem it to be news. But that was the majority mindset prevalent in that news department at that time. Everything Democracy Now! Did with its award-winning team of journalists was suddenly frowned upon as unbalanced, knee-jerk liberalism or advocacy activism journalism. Professional jealousies were so heavy in the air you could see it. And the PNN News was often compromised out of pettiness on those occasions when these individuals were producing the newscast. Dan Coughlin, a fair-minded, compassionate, intelligent, committed producer, was ridiculed and undermined at every opportunity. He was made a target of their campaign to gain permanent control of the newsroom. And they went about this with the quiet endorsement of Lynn Chadwick and Dr. Mary Frances Berry, sort of like a wink and a nod. On two occasions, I spoke personally to Dr. Berry about the forces that were at play in the newsroom. Dan and I both met with Lynn Chadwick on a number of occasions. They listened, they made promises, and then they acted in ways directly in contradiction, contrary to what we had discussed. They had aided and abetted in creating an extremely hostile environment for Dan and I in the newsroom. Then Dan's duties as producer were reassigned. He was no longer to head up the news. He was given a bogus assignment, which to this day has not been fully defined. The only thing that is clear is that he'll have nothing whatsoever to do with producing the PNN News. Dr. Berry would no longer accept my phone calls. Now here's a woman that, you know, I had long respected. Someone I considered to be among the icons of black civil rights leadership. My 15-year-old son was portraying her profile, her work, as a subject for a history essay that he was doing in school. I was dumbfounded by her actions, and, you know, quite frankly, I was really hurt by the rejection. Before I resigned, I made one final attempt to put into writing all of my concerns about the direction of the PNN News. I was the only African-American journalist in that department at the time. Our engineer is African-American, but rarely ever participated in the actual content decisions that went into the show. My opinions as anchor of that show were completely and utterly disregarded. And the chairwoman of the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights was one of the people that was completely ignoring my concerns. To this day, I have not gotten so much as an email from Dr. Berry. And we all know how long it takes to write an email and hit that button, send. Well, at least most of us did. I could not and cannot understand why she chose that course of action. But if this network is to ever return to the bold, courageous outlet for peace and justice that it once stood for, change has got to take place at the top. And yes, I know that Dr. Berry is, for all intents and purposes, out. But I urge you to look closely at those left to carry out her agenda. Examine the role they played throughout this ordeal and ask yourself what these individuals might have done to gain the trust of Dr. Berry, to be handed the mantle, so to speak. And then decide whether you think there's been a genuine change at the top. If your answer is, I don't think so, then remain vigilant of the management. Write, email, telephone. Let these new players know of your concerns. Demand that they do what's necessary to heal this institution. Let them know it's not over just because the players have changed, but the game is still the same. Force them into dialogue about what they intend to take, what direction they intend to take this network into from here. And so when I explain why I left because I could no longer do my work. Sure, I could have continued to have performed my job as the anchor, but I couldn't do my work. And those of you may understand that there's a difference between work and a job. You know, work is the reason you get up in the morning. It pushes you out the door. I mean, it's your motivation, your drive, your passion. It's not just collecting a paycheck. Your work is when you make, let me just take one more phone call. One more phone call to get that source. Just one more. That's your work. Your job is just something you just show up. 5 o'clock, I'm out of here. Your work gets you up early, keeps you there late while your kids are at home, perhaps needing some attention. So, you know, when I realized my work was being compromised, I knew that was unacceptable. And there was no reason for me to stay. So, we all fight our battles in our own way. But I intend, you know, while I've left Pacifica, I remain committed to the progressive cause and will until the day I die. And while... Thank you. While I pursue other avenues for this expression, I urge you all to fight for the station, the network that we all have grown to love and cherish. And I'm a firm believer in the concept that all things work for good. All things work for good. And I would invite you, my friends, to just hold that thought in your consciousness as we examine the lessons of the tumultuous chapter in the history of this truly, truly precious institution. All things work for good. Peace and blessings. Thank you all.
Dan Coughlin, and we're really delighted and privileged to have him here with us. Dan Coughlin was Pacifica radio news director until last November, when he was summarily ousted just days after airing a factual report on a Pacifica affiliate's boycott of Pacifica programming. Before working as news director, Dan produced Pacifica's award-winning news magazine program, Democracy Now! He came to Pacifica from Interpress Service, IPS, Third World News Agency, a wire service specializing in the Global South. He worked as a senior editor at the United Nations in New York and established a Caribbean-wide reporting and distribution service for IPS out of Port-au-Prince, Haiti. He has written widely for a broad range of national and international publications, from the Jakarta Post in Indonesia to El Nacional in Santo Domingo and The Nation, The Village Voice in the United States, someone who brings a rich background and also a lot of information about the current situation, I think, that we're all focusing on today. Welcome, Dan Coughlin. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. Can you hear me? Thank you, Don, for that sunny Southern California welcome. This is my first time here in Los Angeles, and I'm moving. I can't wait to come here from dreary old New York, where it's still winter. Don, thank you very much for the introduction. I'm not so sure that writing for The Nation magazine is something very positive these days, but so be it. And I also want to thank the organizers of this event for inviting me and bringing so many different people from all around the country to talk about this crucial issue at Pacifica Radio, arguably the most important issue facing the meeting on behalf of the network. I am expressing my own individual views. I am, as they say, exercising my First Amendment rights, and I do not expect to be disciplined or punished for doing so. I don't want to get too much into the nitty-gritty of Pacifica today, even though you're probably all waiting for that, but I do want to put the events, though, at the network over the last year into some kind of broader political context. And then what I'd like to try to do is offer some kind of vision of where and how Pacifica should move in the years ahead. As most of you are aware, in the last 15 years, and especially in the last 4 years, we've seen a truly stunning process of media consolidation. This process has nowhere been more dramatic than in radio broadcasting. While it's easy to see a San Francisco Examiner or a New York Newsday disappear from the streets, it's less easy to see Westinghouse gobble up radio stations all across the country. One effect of this process, of course, is that Pacifica's 5 FM licenses, which were once commercially worthless, are now all of a sudden valued at probably more than $200 million. And it is this commercial context, the increasing corporate pressure that is so profoundly affecting all of public broadcasting, just like corporate interests are affecting public telecommunications, public utilities, public health, public education. This is a worldwide process, and it has a name, and it's called globalization or Thatcherism or privatization. And Pacifica Radio, as a public broadcaster, is not immune from these political currents. In fact, for all intents and purposes, much of public broadcasting in this country today does not exist anymore. And I'm not just talking about the corporate underwriting of the Lehrer News Hour or public TV or radio shows now being tied to specific commercial sponsors like Archer Daniels, Midland, GE, or Merck. Public broadcasters have now unambiguously linked their futures with private capital. For instance, NPR has just joined with auto giants like Ford and Daimler Chrysler and telecommunications companies like Loral and Lucent to develop satellite radio. A new radio receiver will soon be installed in your car that will link to a programming stream digitally broadcast from satellites. Daimler Chrysler has invested $100 million in this project. The Blackstone Group, a very famous Wall Street firm, has invested $200 million. And I can tell you that Daimler Chrysler is not investing $100 million to hear stories about Daimler Benz in the Nazi slave labor camps in Germany in the 30s and the 40s. Nor are they investing that kind of money to hear about the environmental record of Daimler Chrysler's Jeep plant in Toledo, Ohio. So you can see that this process of corporate involvement in public broadcasting will have a direct impact on the content that we hear. And now the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the federal agency that funds public radio, is now, in fact, funding NPR, providing NPR $1 million to create programming for this new private venture. And this is another example of how the public treasury is in the service of private industry. So public broadcasters have linked up and linking their futures to Ford and Daimler Chrysler and Lucent and Sony, and not to local communities, not to the farm workers of the Central Valley, not to the new social movements against globalization, or even the educational and religious and rural organizations that fought and created public broadcasting in the first place. This represents a fundamental shift in the very idea and practice of public broadcasting, away from serving the public interest to serving private profit. And that's important that we understand what is happening with public broadcasting and has been happening and place Pacifica within that context. So as Pacifica news director last year, I found myself in meetings with representatives from Microsoft, from Public Radio International, a public broadcaster, a very large one, or from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the federal agency, telling Pacifica about news coverage, or how to restructure the network, or how to sell stations, or how to subcontract out station management if a sale was not possible, or why to receive corporate underwriting. This may be shocking, since Pacifica's whole ethos is independent, non-commercial, listener-sponsored radio with a distinct civil libertarian and anti-corporate culture. But in fact, it is the federal government, corporate America, and powerful broadcasters that were and are shaping many Pacifica policies. And this is not a secret. This is the context within which Pacifica is operating. This is the context within which the Pacifica crisis is occurring today. And I think it's important to see Pacifica in that broader mix. Alongside this restructuring of public radio is also a dumbing down of content on both television and radio, which you've all probably noticed and which has been widely commented on. That is, we don't have a lot of hard news anymore. And if you do have some hard news, there's nothing that is really said, and it's very soft. Coupled with those limited hard news stories now are entertainment stories, business stories, sports stories, so that essentially what you're hearing is pretty vacuous. And there is Pacifica is not immune from these social and political forces that are operating out there. So there is tremendous pressure from CPB, public broadcasters, Congress, corporate America to conform, to tone it down, to be so-called balanced, to keep Mumia Abu-Jamal off the air. And their idea of balance, of course, is Coke versus Pepsi, Democrat versus Republican. It is not that you have, when you have General Wesley Clark on the air, that you should balance it with a peace activist. And in fact, even the very liberal idea of the media as the fourth estate, as another check and balance in the system of government, is almost finished. You will never, even that notion has very little currency today. And the pressure is very direct and unequivocal to become dishwater. But there is an alternative for public broadcasters, for media workers, and community activists. We do not have to become allied with private corporations or government agencies and become Washington-centric. We do not need to listen to the sirens and the finger wavers who are telling us to go mainstream and to abandon Pacifica's anachronistic mission of peace and social justice. Instead of eviscerating our community roots, we need to deepen them. Instead of dumbing down, we need to smarten up. Instead of just trying to get into the castle, we need to go to the cottage. And I say that purposely because it's like what Verna just mentioned when she says the derision within the network for itself, for what Pacifica stands for, is very deep. And folks, many people would prefer to be players, would prefer to be in the castle and not in the cottage. And that's an important distinction about where we start our work as journalists and our work as people involved in media organization. And we've seen very successful models of this approach within Pacifica itself. Take a look at Democracy Now! One of the reasons why it's relatively successful, like it breaks stories, is precisely because it comes from the bottom up. It has community roots, and it's sustained by community journalists at a vibrant community radio station, WBAI in New York. And BAI reflects, or has reflected very successfully, the social and political currents that are washing up on its doorstep. Immigration, police brutality, the African diaspora, student sweatshop activists, the international human rights movement, globalization, the struggle for Puerto Rican independence. And this is true at other stations, less and less so now, but it has been true at other stations in the Pacifica system. Many of the finest work, the finest journalists are produced at the community level. Journalists like Verna, she walked in to WPFW in 1988. Laura Flanders comes out of WBAI. Larry Bensky comes out of KPFA. These people did not drop from the sky. They did not drop from CPB or Microsoft or NPR. They grew up with community radio nurturing them, training them, developing them, and becoming some of the finest broadcasters in the country today. WBAI, under the leadership of Samori Marksman, produced some of the best programming and programmers in community radio in recent years. WBAI did improve the quality of its shows. It won numerous awards. It sharply increased its audience over the last decade, and it hit the first $1 million fund.